Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. For at least three decades, perhaps more, there has been an idea about ancient human history, prehistory, perhaps we should say, that in many people's minds has been very appealing. And that is the idea that if you go back far enough, you find that human society was female-centered. And perhaps the person who's most identified with this idea was a Lithuanian archaeologist named Maria Gimbutas, who she's no longer alive, but at one time she was on the faculty at UCLA. She was professor of archaeology there. And in 1974, she wrote a book titled Gods and Goddesses of Old Europe. And this is the way she wrote about this idea. She said that ancient Europe was inhabited by a culture that was, quote, matrifocal and probably matrilineal, agricultural and sedentary, egalitarian and peaceful, and that this society was destroyed by violent Indo-European nomads who brought with them aggression, war, and patriarchy. It's an idea that has been popularized by a writer named Rhian Eisler, who published a book in 1987 titled The Chalice and the Blade. A lot of people will know that book. In fact, we've discussed it here on this program. This morning, however, we'll talk with a scholar who's critical of the idea, who says that not only is there not much in the way of evidence to support this idea, but also that perhaps it's not such a great thing for women to want to embrace apart from the issue of whether or not it's the case or not. Our guest is Cynthia Eller. She is the author of a book that's titled The Myth of Matriarchal Prehistory. The subtitle is Why an Invented Past Won't Give Women a Future, and it's published by the Beacon Press in Boston. She's also the author of a couple of other books, one titled Living in the Lap of the Goddess, The Feminist Spirituality Movement in America, and also Conscientious Objectors and the Second World War. And we're talking with her this morning by telephone. As we talk about her book and this whole idea, we're certainly interested in having people call in. If you have questions, comments, you can do that. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief. And we ask that so we can keep things moving along and get in as many people as possible. But certainly anybody's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Ms. Eller, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And let me ask, I'm sorry to have to do this right at the beginning, but I have two different pieces of information about you, and they say two different things. And I want to make sure that I identify you correctly. One links you with Montclair State University, and the other with Princeton.
I've been linked with both. I'm currently at Montclair State University.
All right. Well, I want to make sure. I didn't want to say that until I knew that was true. So in that case, she is Assistant Professor of Women and Religion at Montclair State University.
Correct.
Okay. Thanks very much. Okay. So when was it that you yourself first encountered this this whole idea of the matriarchal, goddess-worshipping, distant human past?
The first time I recall hearing about it, I was in college in 1979, and I was studying in Greece, and one of my professors, we were touring Minoan Crete, and he was talking about Minoan Cretan civilization, and said that it looked like women might have had a much stronger public role and that what has been called the king's throne room might actually be the queen's throne room, and, you know, just sort of suggested the possibility that these societies were quite different along gendered lines than our own.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is. It seems on the face of it, at least for particularly, I would think, for feminists to be a very appealing idea for a number of reasons. Why do you think it is that it, at least with some people, it has such appeal?
Oh, I think the appeal is pretty obvious. I mean, if you look around, there's been an argument made for years and years, of course, that feminists have always had to try to combat, that society has always been patriarchal and therefore must always be patriarchal, that it's the only way that we can interact as human beings and that it's inevitable. And this is a way of saying that it absolutely is not, and that we can prove that it's not because we were matriarchal or woman-centered or mother-centered for much longer than we were patriarchal, mm-hmm. for, you know, millennia into the past. While patriarchy is just this, very brief 5,000-year detour, as Rhiann Eisler usually calls it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly, I suppose, for those people who want to argue the point, it's appealing that if we talk about what is most fundamental to our nature, then you want to go back, I suppose, as far as you can. And if that's where human history begins, or near where it begins, then you could say, well, if you want to talk about what people really are, mm-hmm. if you want to get back to our basic nature, particularly when it comes to how it is we relate to one another across the gender gulf,
mm-hmm.
then you could say, well, so this is the real thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what we've been looking at recently is an aberration, and that makes it sound much easier for us to go about the project of getting back to something that's more egalitarian, since that's seen as being more fundamental to us.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the evidence that has been offered for the idea that, in fact, we do have this matriarchal past in human prehistory. How does one build the case for that?
It's been built in several different ways. The theory has actually been around and quite influential for about 150 years now. And in earlier times, the main support for it was anthropological. And what was done is there were a lot of, sort of armchair speculations made about what human beings must have been like in the past, coupled with a growing body of ethnographic information that suggested that human kinship could be arranged in different ways, that, some cultures trace their kinship through their mothers rather than their fathers. And from that developed a whole evolutionary scheme that kinship through mothers, long predated any kinship through fathers for a variety of reasons, either that people were having sex so promiscuously that they didn't know who the fathers of individual children were, or that they didn't understand that there was a connection between sexual intercourse and conception, so that kinship could only be traced through mothers. And that was sort of the first version of it. And some of those arguments are still around today. The more common body of evidence used today is archaeological. You mentioned Maria Gimbutas, and of course she did a great deal to put together a whole body of artistic evidence, mostly small sculptures and incised drawings on pottery and whatnot, to argue that there is a large overarching symbol system in these prehistoric, pre-patriarchal cultures that is woman-centered, that's mother-centered, that is based on a religious system of goddess worship rather than worship of a single god, which we see more commonly now in the West.
Mm. So in terms of actual evidence that one might hold in one's hands, mostly here what we're talking about is the kind of sculptures that people have seen. Perhaps they've seen them in museums, they've seen photographs of them, sculptures that obviously are women that exaggerate their femaleness, and from that you draw the one might draw the conclusion that if that's the things that you're making sculptures of, then it must mean that there's something really, really important about this, particularly the fact that women have babies, and that's the source of life, and so you emphasize their breasts, and perhaps you emphasize their genitals. And if you look at sculpture like that, that seems a natural sort of conclusion to draw, that, well, these people made these images, so it must have had some kind of sacred significance, and so stressing the female and the creative aspects of the female, that then that leads you to say, well, then that must mean that women really were women, and their creative, their literal creative activities were at the center of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very much the argument that's made. And, it definitely has a certain logic and appeal to it. But unfortunately, there's a lot of evidence on the other side. There's other ways to interpret that sort of evidence. For example, now, if somebody who did not have access to any of our language just dug up contemporary American culture, they would find all sorts of effigies of women that emphasize their breasts. And I'm thinking, of course, here, the Barbie doll. And they might decide that these were goddesses and that people were worshiping the female creative aspect or the nurturing aspect of women. And, of course, they would be completely wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, is that, though, necessary? I mean, one might well make that point, but that then does that really mean that the ancients weren't worshiping these
figures? Oh, absolutely
figures?
Not. Absolutely not. I don't think we can know what the ancients were worshiping with any certainty. Hmm. I think there's a good chance that they were worshiping goddesses. There are several arguments to be made about the figurine assemblages that make them seem more like religious images than like Barbie dolls. One is the way that they're quite stylized. Another is some of the contexts they're found in, that they occur along a spectrum of finished to unfinished, which suggests that they might be used for ritual purposes and that the more unfinished ones are ones that had to be made in a hurry for some ritual use. So, you know, I don't think it's unlikely that these were images of a goddess. They might not have been. We really don't know.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it is my understanding that, in fact, we're still trying to think about, and maybe what will be reduced to is continued speculation about what these figures mean, because we don't know precisely what it is that they mean. We're just kind of imagining what they mean or thinking about what they mean and taking it in as much as we can what evidence there is, but it's very difficult to draw an absolute conclusion just based on what we have and what we know.
Exactly. Archaeologists have gone back and forth from the time that the discipline formed and even before, when people were digging up remains from prehistoric civilizations. They've gone back and forth between wanting to talk with a lot of certainty and making grand claims and then going through periods of backing off and saying, wow, we really don't know, you know, 1/100th of what we thought we knew. And all these things can be interpreted differently. So, you know, one can go back and forth on that kind of spectrum. I'd say that I land towards the we can't really know very much end of the spectrum, because it seems to me that there are plausible competing interpretations of things like these figurine assemblages or things like matrilineal kinship. And, you know, you can't really ever decide. There's not going to be proof, which makes it a very convenient religious myth, but not a very good scientific history of the human race.
Mm-hmm. So it's, since we don't have a lot of stuff from this period to draw conclusions based upon, then are we really talking about mostly what this idea is based mostly just on this, on these figures of women, or is there anything else that one might...
There are other sorts of information, yes. The changeover from more female-oriented societies to patriarchal ones is usually dated to around 3000 BCE, which is, and it's usually a story told about the Middle Eastern and Southern Europe, and that's around the time that literacy was developing. So part of the evidence that's offered for this theory of a changeover are myths that talk about a changeover from goddesses to gods, or a changeover from women's political power to men's political power. And the thought is that these are recording previous events that took place. There's also, for years, linguists have tried to figure out where the Indo-European group of languages came from, what the presumed homeland of it was. And there's an argument to be made that, you know, it's fairly solid that there was a group of speakers of some Proto-Indo-European language living in southern Russia, and that they spread the language out from there throughout Europe and the Middle East. And that, you know, the suggestion then is that it was done in a violent fashion and by patriarchal people to people who were goddess-worshipping and mother-centered.
Mm-hmm. And there is a focus on the case is built on this particular, these particular people were, who they were, what they were doing, one in this one particular place. What about the people who were living in the rest of the world, or were there people living in the rest of the world?
There are more global arguments made too that try to universalize the story more, and those tend to be linked with ideas about kinship, which we talked about earlier. That if men did not understand that they played a role in reproduction, their discovery of that would revolutionize relationships between the genders. And, you know, some people think that understanding came only quite recently. Speaking on the big evolutionary timeline. Another more global argument that's made is that when societies are based around hunting and gathering or small-scale farming, that women tend to have more power and more say in those societies. They tend to have more authority. They're more centered into the whole economic basis of their society. And this is sort of a Marxist argument that that Engels first enunciated in The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State, that the downfall of women was the advent of capitalism and vice versa. Hmm. That when men, get access to large-scale farming techniques and from there, trade and, out of that develops sort of feudal systems and capitalistic systems, and patriarchy is an outgrowth of that.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Cynthia Eller. She is Assistant Professor of Women and Religion at Montclair State University. And if you're interested in reading more on this subject, the book is The Myth of Matriarchal Prehistory, and the subtitle is Why an Invented Past Won't Give Women a Future, and it's published by the Beacon Press. And we have a caller who's been waiting patiently. We'll bring him into the conversation. Other people who are listening are certainly welcome to share their thoughts, ideas, questions with us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere you can hear us, that is 800-222-9455. And let's go to our first caller here, I believe, in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi, great topic. Welcome. How do you get received when you discuss this, first of all? Do people get upset about you discussing the myth of perhaps the matriarchal age?
Well, I'd say the reception has overall been quite positive, but I think that mostly has to do with the settings in which I've talked about it, which are usually academic. And I think a lot of academic feminists over the last 20 or 30 years have had a lot of questions about this theory, but haven't sort of wanted to raise anyone's hackles by attacking it.
But certainly pop culture has taken it and run it. Thank you for pointing out the Eurocentric nature of our view of the rise of civilization, because at the University of Illinois, I had an instructor who was an American that had been trained in Eastern Europe, and therefore she had a very strong evidence, economy-based kind of thinking, and she always pointed out that when we look at culture, we have to remember that things people call, quote, Cro-Magnon, the rise of Magdalenian culture, which some people may think of as the Stone Age, that this is just a phenomenon of preservation, that culture existed long before then, and that in Africa maybe agriculture went back incredibly far back. The numbers she mentioned were in the tens of thousands. So when we think about culture, that really blows my mind that, there's such a Eurocentric bias by the Victorian scholars, I guess, towards their own material. And she talked about Marxism and how she felt you get the rise of a warrior class, and I don't know if that was standard Marxism. It's dependent on agricultural systems, first of all, existing, because that's important, people cooperating, like at Mohenjo-Daro and other really ancient sites in southern India. But then once people have extra food, you get, like, people trying to exploit that. And I think that's a more telling myth maybe than the matriarchal myth.
And that's one that's been incorporated into a lot of different versions of matriarchal myth. As I said, Engels wrote about this, over 100 years ago, and that was basically his approach. It was a very similar story that he told, only his focus was on economy rather than on religion. He didn't consider this whole changeover from mother goddesses to father gods to be particularly interesting or significant. It was, superstructure. But the more common telling, I think, that we hear today in feminist circles rests on this idea that what changed was religion. And I think the reasons for that are pretty clear. It's much more appealing to believe that it's linked to religion because that's something that we can more easily address than our global economy. If women's equality is strongly linked to being in cultures that have no surplus, that are hunting and gathering or small-scale agriculture societies, we don't have a good way to return to societies like that around the world. That's an incredibly difficult thing to think about doing. But the idea that we could just change to worshiping a goddess and thinking about the female principle, that this would take us back to a time, you know, not only of women's equality, but also a time of peace and of plenty and harmony with nature. It's a very, very compelling sort of story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is. But I think if you look at just the rise of cultures in general, even in historical times, just from my perspective, you have the Roman and Greek society being looked to by the Victorians as, you know, just the have-all and be-all of
mm-hmm,
the world. And,
mm-hmm.
And so even though everything's filtered through, of course, a very patriarchal set of cultures over many centuries, you still have the Keltoi queen, Boudicca, and other figures who are matriarchal and very warlike. In India, you also have, of course, Kali Durga and mm-hmm. other goddess forms who are historically still present, mm-hmm. you know, and they're not particularly, you know, all kind and all gentle.
Mm-hmm. So, I think one problem with the story is in the way that, you know, if you see somebody like Margaret Thatcher today, you don't usually say, well, there's proof of matriarchy and how powerful women can be. And yet when you look back at a Celtic queen or at a figure like Kali, that's taken to be proof that the women of that society had a different status than we have now in America. And I think that's very contentious. It's, you know, it could well be that there were a lot of queens prehistorically, that there were a lot of goddesses, but that doesn't really tell us if things were qualitatively different than they are now, which is the claim that's made.
Right, because we're looking through a patriarchal filter, but there are, in historical archaeological contexts and in modern contexts, there are matrifocal, if you want to call them, economies. I mean, even in some of the nations of the Middle East, which people would consider to be very patriarchal, we have property.
Mm-hmm.
Women can own property, and it's only actually in like the last 70 years that some of these cultures have switched over to women not having property. So obviously the two are balanced. I'm just curious, do you study things like paganism?
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. My book before this one was on the feminist wing of the neo-pagan movement.
Okay, cool, because I think people should be encouraged to create their own myth, but there seems to be a real need for people to be able to say, I can trace this back to the Stone Age, and just instead of just saying I can trace this back to my unconscious or
mm-hmm.
my higher power. From my experience as a small child in Mexico in the 60s and 70s, I saw a very strong form of a mix of what would have been, you know, pre-Columbian in Mexico
mm-hmm.
and Catholic culture. And it would have been, quote, witchcraft, bruja or healing, curandero or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but it was very Catholic. I mean, it was definitely not pagan at all.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious. I feel, and this is just my own personal belief, that the growth of the modern paganism movement actually goes back to the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And they may search for, you know, this continuous line going back through, you know, the Middle Ages to this matrifocal culture, but I think it's more a modern recreation, and I'm just curious about that. And I don't mean to offend anybody, but I'd just like to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, I think a great many neo-pagans are coming to that understanding themselves. They really are saying that neo-paganism is their own creation, that it's basically 20th century in its roots. And they've gotten less and less attached to the absolute historicity of this story. The reason I focused my book on feminist versions of the story is it seems to me that they're more wedded to the idea that this is historical truth. They're not as flexible about saying, well, we can use it imaginatively as a story to inspire ourselves, and are more inclined to say, you know, why aren't our children being taught this in school? This is, you know, this is the real history, and it's been hidden from us by the patriarchy.
We are at our midpoint here, and again, I just want to mention that people are, if you're interested in being a part of the conversation, you can certainly call us, 333-9455, or WILL, if that makes it any easier. That's for people here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-WILL. And again, our guest is Cynthia Eller, and she is Assistant Professor of Women and Religion at Montclair State University and the author of the book, The Myth of Matriarchal Prehistory. The subtitle is Why an Invented Past Won't Give Women a Future. One of the things that we've talked a little bit about and a point that you make in the book is that one of the most common explanations for why prehistory was matriarchal is this idea that prehistoric people didn't essentially know where babies came from. I mean, they know they came from women, but they didn't understand that sexual intercourse resulted in conception and that resulted in babies. And it seems, though, a little difficult to think about what these societies were said to be like in other ways, and to imagine that these people didn't have such a basic understanding of reproduction. Where does that idea come from, and where do we actually first have some evidence, if there is any evidence, of people understanding exactly how reproduction occurs?
Well, it's important to say that the theory came before the evidence. And the theory came from early anthropologists just speculating that this is something that human beings must have learned at some point. Going on the assumption that lower animals and other primates don't understand the facts of reproduction, that somewhere along the evolutionary line we came to learn it too. And by looking at different cultures around the world and seeing how they trace their relationships among their families, there was this suggestion that some sort of understanding about a female-centered version of reproduction must have preceded the understanding we have now that it takes both men and women to make babies. And part of that speculative argument is that, you know, why would you see the two things as being connected? Because they're 9 months apart. And you don't, you know, even the signs of pregnancy, you're not going to pick up on, you know, right after the deed is done. Not to mention that you have sex a lot without having babies and without getting pregnant. So the idea that it's that particularly that causes a pregnancy, you know, is something that is culturally variable because, you know, people will say, well, yes, you have to have sex, but also God has to, you know, put a baby in your womb. And, I mean, there are practicing Christians today who would make that argument. And other cultures make different sorts of arguments, that you have to eat a certain food or dream a certain dream or something, but that something additional is required. The argument that sex is not required, that it's optional, as I say, the idea was there before the evidence, but the basic evidence that was most celebrated was when Malinowski, a famous anthropologist, investigated the Trobriand Islands. And this was, I think, in the 1920s and 1930s he was there. And these people argued to him quite directly that men didn't have a role in reproduction, that sex was not what made babies. Since then, other ethnographers have suggested that that's basically a religious belief and that everyone in the Trobriands knows where babies really come from and they know that sex is really involved. And they didn't tell that to Malinowski for, you know, a various set of reasons, but that, you know, they were as familiar with the facts of life as anybody else.
I have a couple of other callers, and I want to get to them in just a second. But I think before we end up finding ourselves at the end of the program, I wanted to have you talk a little bit about the sort of the other aspect of this book. It's in addition to looking at the evidence or lack of evidence for this matriarchal prehistory. The other part being why it is that you also argue that, aside from whether or not we can support this, why it's a problematic notion to embrace the idea, and why it is, to take the subtitle, why an invented past won't give women a future. Why is it that the idea, even though it's very appealing, you would argue has some problems connected with it?
Well, one problem, of course, is the one we've already discussed, which is that it's invented. So once you try to go back and really find proof, you won't find it. But even apart from that, even if people were to just say, well, you know, we're using this as a myth to help us learn to live in other ways, in a nutshell, I consider the major problem to be that the notion of femaleness that underlies this is very reductive. And it's reductive in a very familiar way, that of seeing women as being characterized primarily by their ability to give birth, by the fact that they tend to nurture children cross-culturally. And I'm not saying these aren't important facts, but they tend to put women's power in the place women's power has always been, which is, you know, in the family and in the idea of you know, women as having this special kind of maternal instinct. And I think that that's that's been a problem for women for a long time, and it's certainly been possible for societies to look at women in that way, to admire women in that way, to, you know, practically venerate the whole idea of maternal instinct, and nevertheless to treat women very badly in the public sphere and to not allow them certain kinds of roles and certain kind of rights that are, you know, routinely given to men.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you explain it that way or talk about it that way to think about the fact that feminists have so embraced this idea, who otherwise would have the idea that all options should be open to women, that women's and their entire lives should not be child-centered and baby-centered and family-centered, that they should be able to go out and have careers, and in fact they should be warriors literally and figuratively, that they would then embrace this idea that as you say, does really say, but really, what women are fundamentally all about. The most important thing about them is that they produce babies.
And it's especially curious given that a lot of the women who are most attached to the theory don't have children. And, you know, they tend to talk not about the actual birthing and raising, you know, rearing of children, but about just the fact that we have the equipment to do that gives us, you know, access to a certain kind of moral truth that men can't have, and that's why women need to be more prominent in society. You know, it's a familiar sort of argument, arguing from women's specialness instead of from women's equality. And, you know, I think that this is just a recent version of that feminist instinct to want to say not just that we're as good as men, we're equal to men, we should be able to do what men do, but that we're not men, we're women, and that's something special, that's something different. We have things we can offer that men can't. So I think it's really appealing to that whole aspect of feminism.
We have other callers here. Let's go to southeastern Illinois for a caller. Line number 4. Hello?
Yes, I don't have much to contribute to the conversation, but one point was, wasn't there a people at one time who believed that women were impregnated by the wind?
Oh, yes. People, you know, people have made that argument, sure.
And, but about these statues, and, again, you know, it's impossible to know, but the thought that would occur to me, naturally, is not so much that there was a case of gods or goddesses or anything else, but simply fertility magic.
Mm-hmm.
Would that, is there any...
Again, it's just really hard to know. That was the first interpretation given to these figurines by archaeologists when they were uncovered.
Fertility magic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's still one of many possibilities.
Yeah.
Another theory that's been proposed is that they're dolls in the same way that Barbie is a doll, or that they were used for initiation rituals that didn't have anything to do with fertility.
Well, it could explain the difference in the some being highly finished and some not being, and it's simply that they were, if women or possibly were making these on their own, that some were better artisans than others.
Well, that's definitely one possibility.
Interesting conversation.
All right, thank you. I guess not to I don't want to exhaust this point, but I guess that some people would say would raise the question. Again, perhaps to bolster the argument that there was something really special about these women's figures, would raise the issue that, well, why is it there aren't any of men?
Well, one of the questions there is that we don't know exactly what characteristics ancient artisans were using to designate sex. We can look at these figurines and see that a great many of them are female, but there are also a huge number of anthropomorphic, you know, looks like human being figurines from prehistoric times that don't have any marks of physical sex. So we can't say they're women. We also can't say that they're not men. And if you take all the sexless figurines and just assume that they're men, then you end up with something close to a 50-50 distribution between these sexless figurines and the ones that seem to be definitely female. So it may be that there was a lot of representation of men, but they just, you know, didn't put penises on their male statues for some reason.
Hmm. Okay. To another caller, this is Terre Haute, line number 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was wondering what kind of insights that are gained by studying the current matriarchal societies that I'm sure are very isolated type situations, but if you could talk about that a little bit, I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
There's actually quite a bit of dispute about whether or not there are any current matriarchal societies. A lot of anthropologists would tell you that there aren't, that there are now and never have been. You know, we haven't ever seen a society that's truly matriarchal, but a lot there hinges on how you define matriarchal. If you define it as, you know, the direct opposite of patriarchy, and you think of the most extreme patriarchal society you can imagine, where women are sequestered and have no rights whatsoever and are sold by their fathers to their husbands and so on, you imagine a counterpart where women have that kind of social power and men lack it that utterly. We do know with a high degree of confidence that we haven't seen any societies like that. We can't really say what existed prehistorically, but it doesn't look like anything like that ever existed. We don't have any good-looking proofs of an absolute matriarchy. But, of course, that's not the kind of society that's usually envisioned by people who tell this story. It's a much more gender egalitarian sort of society. There's something female at the center of it. There's some sense that there's something feminine or female or motherly that is valued by a society. But there, in terms of how men and women interact, the sort of imagined picture is rarely that there are queens and priestesses who run everything, you know, from above and tell men what they can and can't do, but rather that all people are valued, you know, irregardless of sex. And we do, you know, we can, when we look anthropologically, we can see a spectrum of societies, you know, from the very patriarchal, which I just described, to much more egalitarian ones. So anthropologists have spent some time looking at egalitarian ones. Some of them have ventured the opinion that these are truly egalitarian societies. But again, it's a matter of debate, because other anthropologists looking at the same evidence will say, well, then why are there these male-only rituals that, you know, contribute a certain kind of social power to everyone who, you know, only men, who go through them? So there's really a lot of debate over whether or not really truly egalitarian societies have ever existed, but we do know that ones much more egalitarian than our own have existed.
Mm-hmm. We just going back again to the basic story, the idea that there was a society or societies that were matriarchal. These were people who were farmers. They were sedentary. They were egalitarian, peaceful societies. And then what happened was that these nomadic hordes who rode horses that these matriarchal folks had never seen came sweeping in and attacked them and essentially destroyed that culture and that society. Begs a number of questions. That is, these people who were the aggressive patriarchal invaders, not only where did they come from, but if matriarchy was sort of the basic model, then why were these people patriarchal, and why it is, you know, why did they do what they did? Why did they attack these other folks? Why did they move in and destroy their society? There's a sort of basic question about, well, how is it that even the conditions to have the clash of the two cultures occur, how did the conditions come about to even set up the two groups of people and then set them against one another?
Mm-hmm. I think the most common argument I've heard for that is that the invading peoples were, you know, living in a place that was really harsh in terms of its climate and economy and whatnot, and that male strength got a certain kind of, had a cachet that it didn't have among the more agricultural sedentary peoples, and that they just gradually over the force of this difficult environment in which they were living, and sometimes it's said that there were a series of natural catastrophes and whatnot that made these groups sort of resort to an emergency situation where they relied more on male strength, and from there they developed more of a warrior mentality. And when they saw these, you know, happy, peaceful groups that were producing things they wanted, they just went and took them and then imposed their own social system on it. So that's one argument that's made. Another is that this changeover from, you know, a small-scale agricultural economy to one of a surplus economy. Another argument that's made is that the patriarchal peoples, because they were nomads, because they didn't have a place they called home, that this somehow made them more restless or more patriarchal. That's, in particular, an argument that doesn't make much sense, because hunting and gathering people are thought to have been very egalitarian, not only by people who subscribe to this theory, but by a lot of anthropologists, too, and they were nomadic. So, you know, there are several arguments made, but none that are very persuasive. It is one of the more difficult points for the theory.
Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, ABC News recently had a little news segment when they were talking about they were contrasting pictures of cavemen with clubs trying to subdue a mammoth, say, or a big prehistoric bear,
mm-hmm.
and they were saying that the truth is recent analysis of the remains of home sites for, quote, cavemen, unquote, would indicate that a very large portion of their food and their clothing came from rabbits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I kind of wonder why you're attacking our national ability or penchant for taking myths at this particular place, since national myths are kind of our fuel much of what happens in this country on a lot of fronts. I mean, even just current history is full of mythology. Nobody can agree what happened. So even though I, at core, believe it'd be nice to know the truth, quote unquote, and I very much would appreciate somebody actually being definitive about it. I think in the end, it's got to be said that nobody is ever going to be in a position to state that anyway. So given that we are Americans and love mythology and like to pick one mythology which favors our self-esteem, etc., I don't understand why you're picking this particular place to, you know, put your foot down.
'Cause I think this myth is ultimately detrimental to women. I think it leaves women in a very stereotyped version of femininity. And that, you know, a key goal of the feminist movement is to give us a broader sense of who we can be and who we are, and that this actually tends to narrow it down. And I also have a problem with the fact that it's not true. Not everybody does. I mean, a lot of people are willing to say, well, you know, we make up stories. That's what we do. And, you know, whether or not this is true is really beside the point. But I don't think it's beside the point. I think we need to acknowledge that we don't know, because this story is not told as, you know, most commonly it's not told as, you know, isn't this an interesting idea and let's just use this idea for the self-esteem it can give us. It's told as if this is what really happened, and we don't have evidence to prove that it was or even really to suggest that it was what happened.
Yeah, but that's to say that that is what happened, quote unquote, is just a necessary thing that has to be stated. Otherwise, I mean, sure, you know, I mean, that is just the way the game is played.
Yeah, well, I don't think the game's okay.
Well, I don't either, but that's, I mean, we're Americans.
Well, I don't think I single-handedly am going to stop this game from being played, but I think that I want to draw attention to the fact that it's a dangerous game. And that saying we know things that we don't know and claiming things that are speculative as truth, you know, works us into a lot of corners we don't necessarily want to get into.
We got about 5 minutes left. I guess real quick, I should, for anybody who's been just joined us, introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Cynthia Eller. She's assistant professor of women and religion at Montclair State University. And if you'd like to read more about this, you look for her book, The Myth of Matriarchal Prehistory. It's paperback. It's published by the Beacon Press and should be in a bookstore. It came out earlier this spring in April. I wonder, anybody tried to, I suppose this would be sort of a modification of this. Could you, if what you really wanted to do was argue that ancient prehistory was more egalitarian, rather than saying, sort of swinging over to the other edge and saying that it was matrifocal, that it was focused on women, could you actually make a better case for that and steer sort of a mid-course and be on any firmer ground?
Yeah, you can definitely make a better case for that, I think, but you can't make an airtight case for that. You can't make a really good case for that, because we know of too many societies that are, really the only way we have of getting at prehistory is looking at societies that are like that today, or looking at our primate cousins and saying this is how we were really meant to be. And in both places, we run up against examples of very male-dominant societies. That doesn't mean they all were, but it's hard to believe that given the number of male-dominant societies we've found that practice simple economies, that in a prehistory characterized by all these simple economies, there wouldn't be a variation, that some societies wouldn't be male dominant and some wouldn't be more egalitarian, especially if they're spread out all over the globe and they're developing sort of each in their own way. You might expect more variation rather than less.
I guess I realize I'm arguing this from all points, but now I suppose it seems a little from, if you think that the idea of gender equity is good, then there's something a little dispiriting about that point. If then we have to say, well, as far as we know, it always has and society ever has been male dominated.
Well, yes and no. I also find it quite dispiriting to think that all societies were once matrifocal or woman-centered or even just egalitarian, but that collapsed utterly in the last 5,000 years for reasons that we can't really articulate or show. I mean, I think that creates a lot of problems for anybody who desires gender equity, too, because then you have to explain how we lost it and why we might believe that we could get it back now. So in both cases, both partisans of this theory and nonpartisans of this theory, people who would even go so far as to say that societies have always been patriarchal somehow have to deal with a very difficult explanation of the preponderance of male-dominant societies over the last 5,000 years. And I don't think either group really has the corner on, which is the easier explanation to make. Because, of course, it's also possible to say, yes, we've always been male-dominant, or we haven't been uniformly male-dominant, but there's been a tendency in that direction and no corresponding female dominance. But yet we can hope that things might be different now because we're in a very technologically different kind of situation, a different economic situation, or you can argue from a position of human freedom that, innovations get made, that slavery, which was, practically universal for thousands and thousands of years, is, now a very rare phenomenon. And that you could just say that the same thing can eventually happen with the system of sexual slavery, as long as the political movements are strong enough to support it.
So do you think that this idea of the matriarchal prehistory is going to continue to be one that will appeal to people and that people will still be wearing goddess T-shirts and people will still be passing around copies of Chalice and the Blade and it's something that's got legs and will keep going?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I don't think it necessarily is going to conquer a lot of new territory. I don't think it's going to become. I don't think we're going to see it written into our textbooks in the next 10 years. But I think that the craving for a story like this, for some kind of hope, is so strong that it really overrides, a lot of the considerations that I've been talking about.
Well, we have come to the end of our time, and we'll have to leave it there. We want to say thanks very much for talking with us.
No, thank you.
We appreciate it. Our guest is Cynthia Eller. Again, she is Assistant Professor of Women and Religion at Montclair State University. And if you would like to read the book that she's written on the subject, it's titled The Myth of Matriarchal Prehistory. And the subtitle is Why an Invented Past Won't Give Women a Future. It's published by the Beacon Press out of Boston.